Hello, and a very warm welcome to No Heathen Land, a podcast retelling macabre, intriguing, and just plain weird stories of the past from God's own country, Yorkshire. In my opinion, Yorkshire is the perfect breeding ground for the most weird and wonderful tales. In Yorkshire, we have the rolling, vast countryside of the Dales, dark, tangled woodlands, remote back roads, but also industry, hard labour, a history of staunch religion, farming, tight-knit communities, immigration, a welcoming attitude, intolerance, riots. Much of this documented and a vast amount not. It's the stories in between the newspaper headlines that I really want to get into. Through my experience of working in local history, it's really quite surprising how many odd tales you come across simply looking into one single person's family history. A newspaper article, a diary entry, a theatre playbill, a photograph. I'm very lucky to have made friendships and connections with interesting and enthusiastic people right here in Yorkshire. Each episode will feature one of them as a very special guest, where we'll delve into some of the stories we've come across that have fascinated, baffled, and sometimes unnerved us. Because of the subject nature of this podcast, some stories will not be suitable for everyone. Please approach with caution.
Hello, and welcome to No Heathen Land. I feel like I've been away for a while, but I suspect no one will have noticed. Anyhow, it's been a couple of months since I've recorded and uploaded an episode, but here I am, I'm back, with a really fantastic guest. Matthew Bellwood is a storyteller, actor, writer, educator, and all-round interesting human. Matthew has done and does so much cool stuff that I just won't do it justice here, but I've put links in the description to Matthew's work, which includes walking tours of Leeds, installations and theatre pieces, all of which are meaningful and impactful, incorporating communities into his work. I'd urge you to go and check out as much as you can from Matthew. He's really excellent. So who better than an actual storyteller to recount a tale of the really quite awful and infamous Mary Bateman. Also known as the Yorkshire Witch, Bateman was a criminal mastermind of sorts and an expert con woman. The story of her short life is really shocking and fascinating. Matthew tells it brilliantly, and I'm sure you'll be as captivated as I was. I hope you enjoy No Heathen Land, Season 2, Episode 6. Okay, welcome Matthew Bellwood to No Heathen Land. First of all, I just wanted you to introduce yourself a little bit and tell me about what you do. And this is probably going to reveal why I would have liked you on the podcast.
Sure. So my name's Matthew, and I'm a storyteller and a writer based in Leeds. So I do quite a big mixture of things, really, to earn a living. So I work a lot with primary schools, running workshops that are often based around sort of history topics on the primary curriculum. And I also do sort of oral storytelling, sort of traditional tales from different cultures. I'm very interested in kind of British folklore as well. And I also make theatre, so I make sort of site-specific performances in different places around the city. So the last big piece that we did was in Rounding Park last year for the 150th anniversary of the opening. And I've also worked with the library service quite a lot over the years.
Yeah, so that's how I know Matthew, and we've got like a couple of mutual friends. So I've worked with you a little bit before, definitely with like kids stuff. And that was really exciting, so I'm just really excited to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. And
everything that Matthew's done that is sort of like available to listen to or see will be linked in the show notes, so especially like the oral history tours that you've done, which is very exciting. So I'll have all those linked if anyone wants to listen, which I would definitely urge you to do. So we're going to jump straight into our subject today, because I'm so excited about this. So it's something that I know a little bit about, but definitely not enough, and it's one of those things that's like always on the back burner, like I really should look into this person and It's just right up my street. So do you want to tell us who the person is that we're talking about today?
So we're going to talk a little bit today about Mary Bateman, who was given a kind of a title at the time of her death, the Yorkshire Witch. In fact, I think it had been in use a little bit during her life as well. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's a sort of early true crime story from the beginning of the 19th century. Well, I suppose her crime reign sort of began at the end of the 18th century, but her death happened in 1809. Mm. And I guess there's a bit of a kind of, well, quite a long afterlife for her as well as a sort of celebrity criminal.
Yeah.
That began with her trial and continues to this day.
I feel like she's one of those people that even someone who isn't into you know, local history or like true crime history knows the name.
Yeah.
Just to say, we are recording in the library today, which is next to the town hall, and the town hall clock is now going, which I think is atmospheric.
Very atmospheric. Yeah, so times of doom.
I feel like she is infamous.
She is, absolutely. Yeah. And I came across her, I think, for the first time in, 2014, I was doing a project, a year-long project called 365 Leeds Stories. So that was working with sort of different people around the city, exploring their local areas and finding out, sort of gathering people's personal stories, but also fitting them into the kind of the wider story of Leeds as a city. And we ended up making a labyrinth in the exhibition space here.
Yes, I remember
it. The Central Library. as a kind of way of sharing back all the information that we'd found. And Mary Bateman was one of the people that I encountered for the first time then. And I think I found her in this little book here, which is called Criminal Leeds. And I think this was given to me by my uncle. And it's got sort of various slightly sort of... what's the word for them? Not exploitative, but they're kind of... I don't know quite what the word is there. They're all of a piece. We've got the terrible murder of Mr. Leonard Skerr, the Farnley Wood plot, the things about Charlie Peace, who's a kind of very famous suffragan criminal from the late Victorian period. And Mary Bateman was in here. And I've since sort of found accounts of her life in sort of lots of other publications. And also got this little book here, which I had to kind of... sent off to be printed from the original pamphlet, which is The Extraordinary Life and Character of Mary Bateman, the Yorkshire Witch, traced from her earliest steps of her infancy through a most awful course of crimes and murders till her execution at the New Drop near the Castle of York.
Nice snappy title.
It's very snappy title, yeah, absolutely. So this was published pretty much contemporaneously with her trial in 1809. Mm-hmm. And it's credited to Anonymous. But there's a really good book which I'd really recommend, which draws a lot on this pamphlet because it's the main source of information we have about Mary, which was written by a woman called, I think, Summer Strevens. I'm sure we can put a link
for this as well.
Yeah. And she posits that it might have been written by Edward Baines, who I think is Edward Baines Sr., who was the proprietor of the Leeds Mercury newspaper at the time. So I think it's certainly published, I think, by his publishing company because his name is at the back of the pamphlet. Mm. So although we don't have an author, it may very well have been Edward Baines himself. So yeah, Edward Baines, Printer Leeds, is there on the back page. So it's a really interesting pamphlet. It's slightly moralising in tone, and there's a few little bits that are printed in it that sound a bit less like things people might have actually said and more kind of the interjections of somebody who's trying to make a moral point about the sort of life of this terrible woman and the thing, you know, and make a judgment about the things that she did. But it's a really interesting, it's quite a fun read if you can get past the kind of old typeface and things like that. I guess, shall we just do a little potted history of her?
Yeah, go for it.
Brilliant. So she was born, as far as we know, in Aisenby, which is a little village near Thirsk. Mm. And there's a baptismal record for her in 1768. So we're not entirely sure when she was born, but she was certainly baptised in the early part of 1768. And she was a third of six siblings, so four girls and two boys. And we've got a record, thanks to the extraordinary life and character of Mary Bateman, of her first crime, which was in 1773. So she would have been about 5 years old at the time. She was supposed to have
stolen. What kind of crime can you do when you're five?
Stealing shoes, apparently. So a pair of moccasins, or moroccos, that's the word, moroccos, which were kind of, it's a kind of soft leather shoe, which she apparently hid in her father's barn. And she was later found to have been hiding them. And admitted to the crime. So this is her earliest excursion into theft. Mm-hmm. She grew up in this little village, and there's sort of suggestions that she may have hung out with the gypsies who came to Topley Fair nearby every mm-hmm. year, and may have learnt sort of tarot reading and sort of charm making and things like that from mm-hmm. them, or either directly from them or by observing them. And that's something she became known for in her later life. And at the age of about 19, she moved to York and took a job in one of the big houses there as a servant. And again, the implication of the pamphlet is that she had to move from Thirsk because she'd already had various domestic service jobs in Thirsk and had gained a reputation as a pilferer of small items. So she ends up in York and again is dismissed for theft from her employment, which takes her to Leeds in 1788. And she seems to have a period of time where she holds down steady employment as a mantua maker, which is a kind of overcoat that's worn with a matching petticoat or a contrasting petticoat.
So
it was a particular fashion of the day and seems to have done quite well as that. Mm. And she worked for at least 3 years as a mantua maker. Mm. And whether she was carrying on, you know, pilfering from her employer or I don't know, but she certainly wasn't dismissed on this occasion. And then married a man called John Bateman, who was a wheelwright in 1793 at Leeds Parish Church. And again, there's sort of records of the marriage going ahead. And the account in The Extraordinary Life says that they married after 3 weeks. So married in haste, and I think he probably had opportunity to repent in leisure. Although he seems very faithful to Mary and stays with her throughout her criminal career. But whether or not he knew what she was up to terms of her criminal career, we don't really know. And there's quite a long sort of section of the pamphlet where the writer sort of tries to discern how much he was aware of her crimes and if he knew the full extent of them, because they did move from fraud and theft through to extortion and murder eventually. He was a wheelwright and, as far as we know, an honest man, but could have been covering it. Either was very, very gullible or was turning a blind eye to a lot of Mary's behaviours.
I think sometimes it's quite fun to think, to make up your own mind about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You'd love to think it's like some like stupid, gullible man.
Yeah.
But that might not have been the case.
No, I mean, he could have been a criminal mastermind.
Absolutely.
We know, we just don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously we've got limited sources and they're very biased against Mary because they're trying to make an example out of her.
So
it's quite an interesting question, but it seems to have been a fairly happy marriage in the sense that they had probably at least three children, and I think from the book that I've read that's really gone into sort of in-depth research, there may have been another two. So there were another two records for young Batemans registered during Mary's lifetime, but they're not necessarily her children. It could have been another Bateman family, so potentially five children. And I think shortly after they married, they took lodgings in High Court Lane, and she was found to have been stealing from a fellow lodger, but the goods were returned, so she wasn't prosecuted for this, although I think he spread about the fact that she'd been thieving. And this is sort of the beginning of a series of moves to different places around Leeds and eventually around the country because her reputation began to precede her. So every time they move, they stay for a little while, and then there's a move to another part of the city, presumably to get away from the stink of whatever she'd been up to.
With the stealing thing, how you say that she returned them, it's kind of sounds like a compulsion rather than a way to like steal things and sell them, which is how you think.
I mean, it's really extraordinary when you sort of read the book. even up to the point when she is in prison in York awaiting her execution, there are stories of her extorting money from fellow prisoners. So what she was going to do with it at this point, it's, you know, and whether or not those stories are true, I mean, they might have been exaggerations, but I mean, yeah, it does seem to be a really compulsive thing that she just does it all the time. She seems to sort of lie as naturally as telling the truth. So I suppose there's questions to be asked about, you know, what her mental state was and whether, you know, whether this wasn't, you know, just something that she couldn't help. And but I guess at the beginning of the 19th century there was not a lot of psychiatric care available, and what there was probably was not of a nature that would be curative. So she's clearly a compulsive stealer, and incredibly good at lying. She seems to be very, very good at convincing people of her good character and trustworthiness. So I think that's how she gets out a lot of the situation she gets herself into. And there is a period where they actually move out of Leeds. So her husband John joins the militia for 3 years, who at the time were a kind of roving band of soldiers who were moving from barracks to barracks. And she goes with him, and I think again this is probably an opportunity to get out of the city for a little while while the fuss dies down. So the sort of things that she was doing was, you know, going to sort of draper shops, ordering large quantities of cloth for her employer. So there's one particular example given in The Extraordinary Life of, you know, she used the name Miss Stevenson. She says, my mistress would like to take 3 bolts of cloth. We'll send 2 of them back and we'll send money for the one that we keep. So 2 get sent back, but no money is forthcoming. And of course, there's no account of Miss Stevenson. So she's just, basically conning people. And there's lots and lots of other stories of sort of similar sort of petty thefts. But actually, the number of them is such that she was stealing quite a large amount of money.
Yeah.
And she's also, at this time, working as a sort of soothsayer, so mainly preying on girls and domestic servants and love charms and things like that. And there's certainly evidence that later on she was working as an abortionist as well, so which I think would have been administering drugs at that time, so probably things like penny oil and tansy as abortificants, which could be quite ruinous to the health of the people taking them. So she's getting a reputation for herself, and they move out of the city. They come back 3 years later, and the crimes sort of continue, but they sort of move up in magnitude and scale. And by this time, she's got a reputation as someone that you go to, a cunning person, in spite of the fact that clearly a large number of people being defrauded, and eventually came to the realisation that that's what had happened to them. So she starts I think it's called screwing down, which is a kind of phrase which is used to describe this process of, if you thought your husband was straying, you'd get a screwer down to come and cast charge things, and you'd pay quite a lot of money for the process to be done. But often the husbands were not straying. I think she was pouring poison into the ear of various people, making suggestions that, oh, your husband's been seeing somebody else and he's going to leave you, but I can do this, so give me some cash. And so that's the sort of thing that's going on. And there's an amazing story, and I think this might actually be before the sort of move away from Leeds, of her conning her own husband, which is like really extraordinary. I think the suggestion is that she had run up gambling debts. So she forged a letter which was taken to his place of work, saying that his father John, who was in Thirsk, so I think he was a town crier there, had fallen ill and was on his deathbed, and that he must go immediately. So he travelled most of the day to get there and found his father in the street crying the news. And when he returned, she'd actually sold all the goods and his clothes were left in the house to raise money. So, you know, she was, but still the marriage continued. You know, he wasn't, you know, she seems to have gotten away with it. So I think she must have been really,
really charming, or really attractive, or both.
I have no idea. I mean, we don't really have a picture of her. So there is, I've got a little engraving. This was the engraving that was on the cover of The Extraordinary Life and Character of Mary Bateman.
She looks like a woman in the 1700s.
Yeah, absolutely. So she's pretty sort of ordinary looking, really. And all the descriptions that are given of her character or her manner of being are that she just seemed extremely trustworthy. Mm. She was very modest in her dress and modestly spoken, and maybe she just gave a really good impression of being somebody that you could trust. Yeah. But clearly there was other stuff going on underneath. So and I don't think we're really probably ever going to know exactly what she looked like. I think there's a scan taken of her skeleton, which is still in Leeds, and I think that was done for a TV show in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And I can remember going to the Thackeray Museum and seeing the skeleton, which is no longer there. And a sort of 3D scan of her face.
Yeah.
And again, you know, she's just a very ordinary looking person. Yeah. So
I think it's one of those things that you, like in the back of your mind, you expect someone to just be, you know,
maybe incredibly striking.
Or, you know, like obviously we think that someone who is got this have this extraordinary life is obviously going to look a certain way, but everyone, most people just look like people, don't they?
Absolutely. And maybe she's possessed an incredible charisma, and I guess that's something that we just.
But I would imagine so.
Really interesting character. And there's another really sort of high profile frauds was there was a fire in one of Marshall's mills, which I'm not entirely sure which one it was. So I know there's a few down in Holbeck, so there's Temple Works, but there's also the building that the Arts Council are in now. I thought it was that one.
Okay.
In one of the books that I've read, they've got a picture of Temple Works, but it was one of the flax mills anyway, Marshall and Benyon's flax mill. And then this was like a big tragedy. There was a number of people, including children, who were killed in the blaze, and many people wounded. And she basically went around pretending, I think, to be one of the mothers, one of the children, or actually on behalf of one of the mothers, one of the children, and went around to the households of people who were in good character in the city and were known for their charitable acts, and basically said, we can't afford winding sheets for our children to wrap the bodies in, and extorted linen from them, which she then pawned for money. And also, having sort of exhausted that particular scam, disguised herself as a nurse from the infirmary and went around asking for linens to wrap wounds in, again, which would have been bandages, probably lower quality cloth. And again, that was pawned. But that, again, that came to light, which I think probably necessitated another move. I mean, it was quite dark, really, I think, you know, to be exploiting a local tragedy.
Yeah, so during all these crimes that she was doing that was sort of like racking up, she was eventually getting caught.
Caught, but it's a particular case that brings her to justice,
and then everything else stacks up.
And then I think all of this stuff then comes to light. But I you get the impression that people either were completely taken in by her, or they were scared of her. So I know there was a particular servant, Winifred, can't think of a surname actually, who again testifies at the trial, who was a messenger for Mary and carried letters, and it's letters that she uses in the fraud that actually sort of brings her to justice. And she was illiterate, so wasn't aware of what she was carrying, and I think was genuinely frightened that Mary possessed some kind of magic power, and that if she turned against her, she would be punished through supernatural means.
So
I think she was really playing on people's superstitious natures at the time, and I guess she was in a position of relative power, in that she was able to read and write, which was quite unusual for a...
That's what I was going to ask her about the letter, because she's obviously however she's using her literacy, she's obviously very intelligent and literate.
Super smart. And you also can't help wondering that, you know, if she'd been born in a different age, if the kind of slightly sociopathic tendencies might have been noticed, and
she'd have been some kind of CEO.
Or, you know, if she might have found other ways of sort of channeling that intelligence and that charisma that she clearly had in order to perpetrate her frauds. But
as just the very fact that as a woman at that time she was literate when yeah. she was not, you know, she was, you know, certainly a sort of lower class woman. She was, yeah, it's quite unusual, I think, and you know, you can't. I mean, it's awful. I'm not justifying any of the crimes because they're really bad, but you know, there's a kind of. It's an extraordinary life that she managed to lead.
Yeah, I think you can be. And there's a certain. You can be impressive, but you can also be horrible.
Yes, I mean, there's a certain chutzpah in it, isn't there? I suppose is what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite an extraordinary person. So yeah, this board with the bandages and the linen is one of the things that she was known for. And then a little bit later, so I think at the beginning of the 19th century, there was. A woman called Joanna Southcott, who was quite well known, and there's a network of chapels sort of set up in her name sort of later on, who claimed visions and had gathered a lot of followers. Mm. And she had a way of offering people entrance to heaven by sealing their name and drawing a circle around it. So it's a bit like a charm, really. So it's a kind of, I guess it's sort of building on Christian mythology, but using it. In her own way, and she was very popular in Yorkshire at the time. So I think noticing this, Mary then set up her own. I mean, this is a scam, really. Pretending to be a follower of Joanna Southcott and offering, she'd somehow got hold of Joanna's seal, and so knew how to offer these charms which she was selling. Mm. And she created this amazing fraud of an oracular hen. So she had a chicken, which she said was laying eggs with messages on from Christ. And I guess there was a kind of, slightly apocalyptic element to Southcott's prophecies.
Yeah.
So they were in advance of the end of the world, we need to do this.
Yeah.
And so the idea that Christ was returning was quite a potent idea mm-hmm. at the time. So the fact that a chicken was laying eggs saying, you know, yeah, he's on his way, was quite a big deal.
Yeah.
And so, depending on the account that you read, I think there was at least three eggs that were seen coming out of the chicken with the words Christ is coming, misspelled, so it's C-R-I-S-T.
Yeah.
Although later there's a letter from Mary in The Extraordinary Life and Character where she gets his name right and she has the H in place. So,
good. So it's not Chris is coming.
No, it's not Chris is coming. It's definitely Chris is coming. But then also she was meant to have charged people a penny to come and watch the chicken lay.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably there were further eggs, or maybe they were ordinary eggs and they were just coming.
Yeah.
They were coming in the hope that one of the eggs with the messages on them would pop out.
Yeah.
But
I'm pretty sure I think we might have discussed this when I saw you last time. I'm sure this is in one of the Mother Shipton prophecy books as well.
Is it? Yeah.
I think so. Maybe that's not 100% from me, but I've definitely read it before, and it's definitely in one of the Mother Shipton prophecy books. But no one wrote about her till, you know, like 500
yeah.
years after, so it could all be sort of muddled in together, just about general witchcraft. But it's definitely one of those little.
I mean, it may have been that she was aware of,
yeah.
you know, that, and that's where she sort of drew the idea from. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's kind of hard to say because. I suppose there were kind of, you know, there are obviously there's books and things that gather kind of folklore and ideas,
yeah.
but I wonder if this is just sort of stuff that's circulated orally and that
yeah.
people were aware of. If you were in the right circles and you had your ear to the ground for supernatural
yeah.
gossip, then maybe the idea of an oracular hen was, you know, just, yeah, of course. You know, yeah. This was the scam. Christ is coming, and this, I guess the fact is that she must have, and I think they were examined by someone in the medical profession, and I think that the conclusion was that the messages had been written on using a kind of acid base,
mm-hmm.
and sort of which had sort of impressed the words into the shell, and
yeah.
then they must have been reinserted into the chicken for it to lay them again.
That's
so
a lot of effort, isn't it?
It's a lot of effort, and presumably very unpleasant for the chicken.
Yeah.
So, So that was one of the money-making scams that she came up with. And there are sort of various others, but her kind of reign of terror came to an end, or in 1809 was the day of her death, but in 1806 she met a couple called Perigos who were based in Bramley, and Rebecca Perigo, who was the wife, had been suffering from a fluttering in her side, and she had been diagnosed, I think, by a doctor, but clearly somebody who was sort of on the very fringes of the medical profession. He told her that it was caused by an evil spell. So she gradually grew more and more paranoid about this and believed that she was under the influence of spirits. And because of her anxiety, I think her symptoms then grew, but I think probably it was panic attacks. So a relative of hers, who I think is Sarah Stead, who had heard of Mary Bateman, I don't know if there's another family called Stead who are conned by Mary, and I don't know if she's a relation of those Steads or if it's a completely separate Stead, but then says, there's this woman, Mary Bateman, you could talk to her, she's known to be able to remove the evil eye. And so various meetings take place, some in Leeds and some at Bramley, between the Perigos and Mary. And she says, I can't help you myself, but I've got a friend who lives in Scarborough, Miss Blythe. She'll be able to sort you out. So there's then correspondence, which goes on for about 5 months between the Perigos and Miss Blythe, with Mary Bateman as the intermediary, during which they're encouraged to part with many goods in their house, and also with sums of money in exchange for charms and advice. And so initially these are, I think, guinea notes that are brought to Mary Bateman's and sewn into little leather pouches, or exchanged for other notes, saying it's leather pouches, which then have to be sewn into the bed linen of their counterpane. And they're absolutely taken in by her, and the correspondence is all burnt, but was reconstructed from memory by William Perigo, the husband, at Mary Bateman's trial. So there were two extant letters from this correspondence, both of which don't say burn this at the end, and they're the most innocent ones. But if William Perigo is to be believed, and I think in all likelihood he probably should be, that is quite sinister, the correspondence, and ends with her encouraging them to eat a pudding containing powders provided by Miss Blythe, and there are implications within the letter that if anything ill towards happens as a result of eating the pudding, they're then to take some special honey which Mary Bateman has mixed powders into as a medicine. And I think it's very clear that these were poisoned items, and I think these were eaten over a course of a week by Rebecca Perigo, and she eventually died, still believing that Mary was on her side. I've got a list here of these items extorted from the Perigos that came up in the trial. So we've got one goose, two pairs of men's shoes, a goose pie, a tea caddy, several shirts, a counterpane, a piece of woolen cloth, a silk handkerchief, a silk shawl, a light-coloured gown skirt, a light-coloured gown cotton, two pillow slips, a new waistcoat, 60 pounds of butter, 7 strokes of meal, 6 strokes of malt, a quantity of tea and sugar, 200 or 300 eggs, a pair of worsted stockings, a pair of new shoes, a pair of black silk stockings, 3 yards of Knaresborough linen cloth, 10 stones of malt, a piece of beef, 3 bottles of spirits, 2 tablecloths, 2 barrels, 2 napkins. So, and there's also money being changed in hands as well.
It's the amount of butter that I was a bit concerned about.
I mean, extraordinary, yeah.
I think it's a lot of butter.
It's a lot of butter. It's a lot of stuff. And I think there was an instance early on where she'd agreed to meet with Rebecca on Kirkstall Bridge, and Rebecca had gone down to meet her. Mary had gone straight to their house, and when William found that his wife had not met her, he went down to look for her. So she was left alone in the Perigo's house early on for a while, and must have done a recce of the premises to find out what they had available and what she could reasonably get out of them. But yeah, I mean, so this is like five months, and I think by the end of this, that obviously no improvement had come to Rebecca's health, and I think she must have decided it was time to get rid of them. So these letters start to come, encouraging them to take these powders, which will put an end to the matter once and for all. And I think the hope was that they would both be poisoned, and because the letters had been burnt, it would be, I don't know, read as a suicide pact or something like that. But unfortunately for Mary, the pudding that was produced, which I think contained arsenic, was so foul that William couldn't manage to keep it down and survived the attack. But even though both of them were eating it, he ate it in much smaller quantities than Rebecca.
Yeah.
And I think this took place over the course of a week, and by the following Sunday, Rebecca died, and a neighbour who gave evidence at the trial said that she was foaming at the mouth, that her lips were black, her tongue was black, and that in order to get near to the body, people were having to smoke tobacco to clear the smell, because she was presumably rotting eternally. So, and there's sort of various accounts of the, you know, William Perrigo describes his wife vomiting green and yellow liquid. So the fact that she kept going with this really sort of gives you a sense of how much she trusted Mary.
And just exploiting desperate people, isn't it?
Absolutely. And on her deathbed, she told her husband not to be too harsh with Mary. So, yeah. So I've got a couple of the letters here just to read.
Yes.
And again, I think these are reconstructed letters. So we have to assume William Perrigo was telling the truth. But
yeah.
So, my dear friends, I will be obliged to you if you will let me have a dozen of your china, 3 silver spoons, 1/2 pound of tea, 2 pounds of loaf sugar, and a tea canister to put the tea in, or else it will not do. I durst not drink out of my own china. You must burn this with a candle, M. Blythe. So, this is Mary claiming she was afflicted by the evil spirits that she was battling on behalf of the Perrigos. And then this is one which is we're into the period now where she was trying to get rid of them. So, my dear friends, you must begin to eat pudding on the 11th of May, and you must put one of the powders in every day, as they are marked for 6 days. And you must see it put in yourself every day, or else it will not do. If you find yourself sickly at any time, you must have no doctor, for it will not do. And you must not let the boy that used to eat with you eat that pudding for 6 days. And you must make only just as much as you can eat yourselves. If there is any left, it will not do. You must keep the door fast as much as possible, or you will be overcome by some enemy. Now think on and take my directions, or else it will kill us all. About the 25th of May, I will come to Leeds and send for your wife to come to Mary Bateman's. Your wife will take me by the hand and say, "Thank God that I ever found you out. It has pleased God to send me into the world that I might destroy the works of darkness, because they are dark to you. Now mind that whatever I say, you do. This letter must be burnt in straw on the hearth by your wife, M. Blythe." So, so she's clearly taking no chances.
It is really sinister.
It's hugely sinister. I think a medical practitioner, Mr. Chorley, was called to Rebecca too late. He found her dead, but he suspected poison. And he took some of the powders and mixed them into a paste, and he gave some to a chicken and some to a cat. And the chicken survived and the cat died. And later, I think some of the powders, or possibly the honey, were given to a dog. And again, the dog was found to was poisoned by them. But in spite of all this, nothing was really done. And William Perrigo was sent away to Buxton for his health to take the waters of the spa there. And didn't return for some time, but he kept up correspondence with Mary Bateman and with Miss Blythe. And so there's this extraordinary episode where she's carrying on conning him, even though he must be suspicious at this point. And there's a great letter, again, that came out of the trial where he comes back from Buxton, and Miss Blythe says, "Oh, if you stayed another week, we'd have bumped into each other, because I've just gone to Buxton." And so she manages to convince him that even though the letters don't have a Buxton postmark, they've been sent on somewhere else and then sent to Leeds for him to read. So she manages to keep this idea going. And let me just find the letter, because it's got this amazing bit of detail. She says that she was delayed because her horse was startled by a hot air balloon, which is
just. Can you use that excuse next time I'm late?
Let me just see if I can find it in the
Again, I think the fact that he carried on this correspondence is probably because he was terrified. She has just killed his wife.
Killed his wife. So it could be that, absolutely. So yeah, my dear friend, I was looking at your planet and I saw you was coming home from Buxton. If you had stopped a few days longer there, I should have had the pleasure of seeing you there. I have happened a misfortune at Scarborough. An air balloon was setting off there. I was riding with my brother in a whisky, and the horse took fright and threw us over, and they got lamed in the hip. And I saw it good for me to go to Buxton. My sister is going with me, and we shall take shipping at Scarborough to go to Liverpool, for my sister comes from there, and I sent to Mary Bateman's for the veil that covered Mary Bateman's child's face when it was born. So I guess this was a caul.
Uh-huh.
And I think that if your child was born with a caul, you could, if you took it to sea with you, it would stop you from drowning. I think that was kind of a popular suspicion. So she's saying that Mary Bateman, her friend's child, was born with a caul, and she's asked to borrow it so that she could go to sea in safety.
Mm.
So, for no ship will sink when they have such a thing in it. For the roads between Liverpool and Scarborough are so difficult. I will send you a few lines when I get there. This letter must be burned as the other. So she's covering her tracks all the while. But I mean, it's great. I mean, I just sort of think the idea of, oh no, I won't just tell him fill up the horse because stuff. I'll start by a hot air balloon. So maybe there was a balloon flight. I've no idea.
I mean, he's probably not going to check.
He's not going to check. No, absolutely. It sounds like such an unlikely lie. But anyway, so this happens, and then a year later, so it's October 1808. He's had some direct meetings with her, and has got wise the fact that she's been scamming him, and that is the point. And bearing in mind that they met in 1806. She's dead now, and a year later in 1807 he looks into the charms that they sewn into the bed linen and discovers that the guineas are gone, and that they replace, depending on which book you read, either with scraps of paper or with dried cabbage leaves and coppers, and realises that, you know, he's been duped and that his wife has probably been poisoned.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the moment where he confronts her, and she says, it managed to get to meet her the next day on the banks of the Leeds Liverpool Canal, and she arranges to give him some medicine that's going to solve everything forever. So,
okay.
Luckily for him, he's sort of wise to this, and he gets someone who we think may be the brother of a neighbour, and I think a Mr. Duffield, who was the kind of chief of police at the time, so they weren't an official body,
yeah,
they were kind of constables to the watch, but so it was an unpaid position.
Mm-hmm.
He's gone to the law at this point. So they follow him at a discreet distance and watch the encounter with Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And she has this little vial with her, which is a mixture of rum, oats and arsenic, I think. So it was examined by someone with chemists, a chemist later on. And they sort of pounce on her and take her into, that they arrest her, essentially. And she says that he had given it to her,
right,
and was trying to poison her in revenge for what he believed had happened to his wife.
Mm-hmm.
So she's still sort of lying at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And she's then in prison for quite a long period of time, because it doesn't come to trial until 1809. So I think it's about 18 months later. And I'm not quite sure what's been going on with the assizes or why it's taken so long to come to trial, but it's quite a considerable time after the arrest. And there's a whole account here in This Extraordinary Life, which is a kind of a description of the trial of Mary Bateman. And we have all the various witnesses and the list of articles that have been purloined come up. And she's eventually condemned to death. So she doesn't really get a defence. There's no one speaking on her behalf, just speaking against her, which is a bit one-sided.
Mm-hmm.
But the weight of evidence, you know, is pretty compelling. And she then pleads her belly and says that I'm pregnant.
Yeah.
I can't be executed. So the idea would be, if that was believed, that she would have a stay of execution until I think the child was nursed. But there was also an opportunity, sometimes sentences were commuted for the mothers then, maybe to transportation or something else. So it was a kind of last-ditch attempt to save her life. And so the judge has the courtroom sealed and asks for a panel of matrons who've given birth and would know the signs of pregnancy to come and examine her, and they decide that she's not pregnant. So mm-hmm. she's then put in jail in York, and her execution is scheduled, I think it's March 1809, mm-hmm. By a kind of, I think it's been called the New Drop. So essentially, I think she stood in a stage and the trapdoor opens. So yeah. It would be pretty swift, provided that the noose has been put on correctly. Mm-hmm. Although, according to the book by St. Stephens that I read, the jailer at the time, who was an ex-criminal who'd taken on the role of hangman to commute his own crimes, yes. was often drunk. I think that sometimes didn't do the best job of attaching the noose. So she's executed with another criminal, and she doesn't make a confession, so she still goes pleading her innocence. She says she has done some small frauds, but she hasn't committed the murder for which she's being condemned. Mm. I've got the letter, which came from Reeves York Castle in the 19th century, and this is a transcript of her letter to her husband. "Dear husband, I do send you here with my ring, that as I had of you when I was more happy and had not disgraced you. You must give it to my dear girl," which you assume is her eldest daughter, mm. "who will keep it forever in remembrance of her poor and happy mother. Though you are disgraced by me, I trust in Christ you will forgive me, as I am sorry and hope to be forgiven. I am innocent of murder. I did get the money many times, but that was all. I did never destroy that woman for whom I am to suffer. I am innocent of that, though I did many things else for which I am much aggrieved. I have made my peace with my God, and I am easy in mind. The worst is when I will part with my blessed baby." So I think her youngest child had been with her in the cell up to this point. So "God bless you. Forgive your poor wife, who is only in affliction for you. Tomorrow will end all here, and the Lord will care for me hereafter. Your loving and sorrowful wife, Mary Bateman." Mm. And she drew quite a crowd, so people had gone to see the execution.
I bet she did.
walked up the York Road from Leeds early in the morning to watch the execution.
Yeah.
And I think there was another criminal being executed at the same time.
Where was the execution?
So this was at York.
Oh, at York, right.
Yeah, so I think the assizes for the county would have taken place there. Mm-hmm. And then after the execution, the body was taken back to Leeds mm-hmm. and taken through the streets to the infirmary. So this would have been, I guess, the old infirmary on Infirmary Street, not the new one, well, the building on Great George Street, which is we know now. And because there was such interest, they opened the infirmary up to visitors mm-hmm. to come and look, I think charging them, I think it was something like a penny or threepence a time, mm. And they raised £30 for the hospital fund. So many thousands of people mm. walked through to look at her lying on a slab. Mm. And then they had a series of public dissections, which raised a further £80 for the hospital fund.
Wow.
And so one of these, I think the one on the eye, which was ladies only, that you bought a ticket for, was conducted by William Hay, who was a very famous surgeon who founded the Leeds Club and was one of the founder members of the Leeds Library. Mm-hmm. A terrifying looking man with eyes that went two different directions from all his portraits. Perfect for a surgeon. Invented various bone saws and things, circular skull saw and things like that. You think, well, lucky she was alive, because I think if I was being operated on him without, you know, proper anaesthetic, and I saw him coming towards me with a circular saw in his eyes in two different directions, I would be terrified. So she was really they made the most of her. And I think that was, if you were convicted of murder, your body could be given for dissection. You forfeited mm-hmm. your right to a proper mm-hmm. burial. And her skin was tanned as well and sold off. I think you could apply for a piece of the skin as a charm. Mm. And up until the late 19th century, I think there's evidence of people writing claiming that they had pieces of the skin. And I think some books were also bound in it. So this is a weird practice. I think it's called anthropodermic bibliopegy, mm. which is like, wrapping books in human skin. So they kept the skeleton as well. So apparently she had an extra rib, so she was considered quite unusual.
Yeah.
And the skeleton stayed in Leeds for a long time and was on display at Thackeray, certainly until about 2015, I think. And it's not there now because I think there's been some controversy, I think, from surviving members of her family.
Yeah.
And I think just, you know, there's a kind of ongoing debate about displaying a few remains in museums.
Yeah.
So it still, I think, belongs to the anatomy department mm-hmm. at Leeds University. And she was on display without her legs. I'm not entirely sure what happened to the legs, mm-hmm. but she was sort of pelvis up.
Yeah.
And I was told by a librarian quite a long time ago that perhaps it was to stop her coming out of her grave.
Oh.
But I sort of think it's unlikely just because she was...
A fun story, though.
A fun story, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. I suppose because she was never officially buried anyway.
Yeah.
And I think part of her tongue was pickled. That went to Bollinghall Museum.
Mm-hmm.
I think was disposed of in around the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
I think one book that I read said it had become so distended you couldn't tell what it was. And I think maybe it was just something they didn't want to have in their collection anymore. So I think it was destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Leeds has got its money out of Mary Maitland, I think,
mm-hmm.
In terms of her sort of afterlife as a kind of celebrity criminal.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's just a kind of extraordinary. I mean, it is an extraordinary life, really, and kind of find it, you know, really fascinating as a, you know, I'm not really into true crime nowadays, but I just think as somebody who forged a strange path for herself at a time when it would have been, you know, opportunities for women to do, you know, anything other than be a mother or work in a factory were small. She had chutzpah. So, yeah.
And I wonder how much longer she could have carried on if she hadn't been found out,
absolutely.
So how old was she when she was executed? So she was
in
her
40s, 40s, yeah. So 1768 she was born, 1809 she was executed. So yeah, 40, 41.
She had a fairly good go of it.
She did well. She did well for herself.
Yeah.
And absolutely. And I think either through fear... or through, you know, charisma and seeming honest, she managed to. The Perrigos were one of a number of families who were under her influence at the time.
Yeah.
And items from their house, from another family called the Snowdons who lived nearby, were found in Mary's residence, and that was sort of offered up as proof of her extortion at the trial. And there's a chance that she may have been a serial killer. So there's another family called the Kitchens who had two sisters, Quaker sisters, who had a draper shop in St Peter's Square, which I think is at the top of Quarry Hill.
Oh right, yeah.
The Northern Ballet Theatre is.
Yes.
Which was quite a fashionable area of the city at the time because I think there was spa water there. And Mary had been friends with them and had worked in their shop. And one of them fell ill and Mary went to nurse her. And this woman died, she was suspected of being poisoned. And her surviving sister and her mother then came to nurse her. And both the mother and the sister were dead within a week. Presumably via Mary's ministrations, and the doctor who examined the suspected arsenic poisoning and wanted to conduct an autopsy, but because there was no surviving members of the family, consent couldn't be gained to do that, so she got away with the crime. And she sealed the house and she told all the neighbours that it was a plague house, and by the time it was opened so that the creditors could claim part of the estate, but say to the road, the house had been stripped.
Mm-hmm.
And all the goods worth any money had been taken from it. So it's very possible that she not only killed Rebecca, but another three people as well.
Yeah.
And maybe more, we don't know. So
definitely just sound like compulsive behaviour. So you said like earlier on she conned her husband into with her gambling debt.
Yeah.
So it's obviously that it just seems like she can't kind of stop doing it.
No, and she must have known she would be found out by her own husband, and at some point they would be. But maybe she just thought she ought to get away with it.
I think the letter to him is very like, oh, poor me. But she was. It does sound like she was very fond of him.
Yeah,
potentially.
And
otherwise, she probably would have killed him.
What do you think? Yeah, absolutely. And you permanently get all the goods and chattels then, don't you?
Yeah.
I suppose. And I think he was left destitute, according to the pamphlet, you know, after the trial. And obviously the children would have been as well. So, you know, it was...
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really Interesting case, isn't it? And yeah, it does sound as though she was compulsive. So whether that's sociopathy or psychopath, you know, she's a psychopath in some way, or you know, however you choose to describe her behaviour now, it's I mean, we can't know because we, you know, we just don't have enough evidence. But an interesting person,
definitely.
Yeah,
I love that story. Thank you.
That's a pleasure. No worries.
Great. So, I'm gonna go and read all these things.
Yeah.
And yeah, anything that we can link in the description, I will do that.
Yeah, I can so put together a little reading list of different places that
And I think most of the things that you've got, if they even if they're yours, we will have them.
I'm pretty
in
sure
the central
library
or the Leeds library possibly. Yeah. So thank you so much.
That's a pleasure.
It was so great. Yeah. So at the end of the episode, I usually just like to chat with my guest about something that you've been enjoying recently. So I did give you a little heads up on this a couple of weeks ago to give you some time to think.
So I've very much enjoyed watching What We Do in the Shadows recently, which I haven't watched, and there's two series up on iPlayer at the moment, so I've just watched those.
Yeah.
And I just started watching an Australian series called Colin from Accounts, which I've been enjoying, so I'm about three episodes into that. So yeah, I recommend them both as a nice alternative to true crime.
Absolutely. So, I'm a big fan of What We Do in the Shadows, so I've watched them all. I think there's five seasons.
Yes, so I think I've watched series two and three.
Yeah, so you must catch up and
I will.
Watch the rest of them. So my thing this episode is that I didn't realise that there was a new season of Inside Number 9, which is one of my favourite TV shows ever.
Excellent.
Have you watched them?
I've watched some of them, and I've not been super consistent with it.
Yeah.
But it's quite nice because you can drop in and
out. You don't have to be. So I think this is series 8, and I can't believe, like, how do you write so many completely separate episodes?
I think they've just got such a good intrinsic understanding of genre that they're able to sort of play. I mean, there's such great little twists and games. That,
so good. Yeah. And usually, so I think there's like about six. Well, there's six episodes in this series, and I think there's usually six in each one. And I didn't realise that there was a new one until yesterday, and I watched them all yesterday in the new series because they're quite short. That's my excuse. And usually, in each series, there's usually like one or two that are a bit like, oh, that wasn't as good. This one, I loved every single episode. They were so good. I really prefer the sort of like ones that are a little bit like spooky or scary or like the horror ones. And these all seem to be pretty dark. So I think that's why I liked all of them.
Yeah.
But it's a really, really good 8th series, I think.
Brilliant. I mean, to get 8 series in is sort of it's impressive. I mean, I was a huge fan of League of Gentlemen when that first came out. And,
ultimate favourite.
Yeah. And Psychoville as well.
Yes,
which,
that is also good.
Yeah.
I also like that both of those series ended. So I don't know how you feel about this, but sometimes I'm a bit like, oh, things just go on and on and on.
Yes.
I can't get bored, and I just feel like I'm always going to be behind. But yeah, 3 series of League of Gentlemen, 2 series of Psychoville.
Done. Absolutely. Yeah, I know. I struggle a little bit with anything beyond 3 series. I get a bit like,
yeah.
I'm sure this is brilliant, but I might need to come back to it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's.
So finally, is there anything that you want to talk about that you've got coming up? What I'm excited to hear what the Matthew Bellwood what are the Matthew Bellwood summer projects?
What are the summer projects? I mean, things are quite quiet at the moment. I'm just starting doing some workshops with Hollybush TCB with an organisation called Skipco that I'll be running through the summer, and sort of just beginning lots of projects really that hopefully will run for a little while.
Yeah.
We'd love to do something in Armley maybe next year, similar to the work we've done in Roundhay, and we've done other projects in Headingley and Meanwood, sort of exploring local history with people who live in the area, and maybe making a book or making a theatre piece that would take place there. So we're just starting to have those conversations with the library in Headingley, library in Armley, and then maybe to other organisations who are based there who we might work with. So
that's really exciting. Well, I'll make sure that I keep up to date with all of that. So thank you so much for coming on No Heath and Land. It was
a
pleasure to have you.
Oh, thank you.
Bye bye.
A great little abrupt ending there from me. I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I did recording it. Isn't Matthew wonderful and such a great storyteller? As I said, all links to everything that Matthew has done are in the show notes, and things that are coming up as well, I will be sure to share. If you want to follow what's going on with the podcast, you can follow me on Twitter at No Heathen Land. You can also follow me on Instagram at No Heathen Land. It's a mixture of some podcast stuff, some memes, basically, but I'd be very happy to have you there. Let's make friends. So I'm hoping to be back soon with another episode. I'm definitely going to have an episode on, hopefully, or around, let's be real, around Yorkshire Day, which is the 1st of August. I sort of missed the date last year, so I will try my best to get something out around then. I've got a really good idea, and I'm hoping it's going to come into fruition. It's going to be a spooky, spooky one. So thank you so much for listening, and I hope to see you again in No Heathen Land. Bye-bye.